Today, welcome to Financial Repression with George Gammon. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, one that is post covering finance and prop news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Today, I'm joined again by George Gammon. Hi, George.
Hey, Martin. Thanks for having me back on, buddy. Can't wait to chat. It's always fun.
Well, it's great. And, it's a long time since we had a chat. The fact of the matter is we are in a very interesting situation at the moment. I just want to spend a bit of time with you today exploring some of those key concepts that you've been exploring on your channel, right? Because it seems to me that a lot of people are lost at the moment, right? There are so many sort of things going on, so many signals that are pushing in different directions. And what I want to try and do is explore some of these signals, right, and try and unpick what's really going on. And I want to start with the Fed. Overnight here in Australia, Jerome Powell was talking to the ECB and he said, look, inflation's going to go on for longer, right? But he's still saying it's transitory, right? And he's still saying that until things are actually really fixed, we're going to have to continue to, provide support for the economy. We will obviously taper at some point, but this is wearing so thin. What's your perspective on what he's saying? You know, does he really know what's going on or not?
If he does, he's not going to admit to it, because their only power that they have is just expectations policy or psychology. But going back to what you're saying earlier, I think it's so true. And it reminds me of a quote from Lenin that was, there are decades when nothing happens, and then there are weeks where decades happen.
Brilliant.
I think we are living in a time right now where there are weeks that are going by that decades are happening, and not only in Australia, but here in the United States. But going back to what the Fed was talking about specifically with inflation, or Jerome Powell, and I think he was up there kind of, playing the game with Janet Powell, or excuse me, with Janet Yellen, and they're going back. And a lot of what they said just didn't make sense if you have even a basic understanding of what's going on as far as the macro elements that are going on behind the scenes. But they talked about this inflation, and it's like everything else. Sure, it's transitory. How long can they continue to say that it's transitory before they kind of disregard the actual definition of transitory, right? I mean, can we have transitory inflation for 10 years? At what point does it become permanent? You know, when do we cross that line in the sand? And I think that's really the question that I would ask Jerome Powell right now. But if you really dig beneath the surface, this all makes sense, because they have to have financial repression, which means they need negative real rates, just like they had in the 1940s, and which they did intentionally, and just like they did maybe unintentionally during the 1970s. Why is this? Because the United States is the largest debtor nation of all time. Let's call it debt to GDP of 130%. And so the only way to get that debt to GDP down where it's more manageable, let's say 50, 60, 70%, is through inflation. Now, I shouldn't say the only way. I should say that's usually the path of least resistance. We could default in a way that would be far more honest, which is what's going on with this brouhaha with the debt ceiling. And that's another topic of discussion that just shows you how insane the world is right now. But, they could just not raise the debt ceiling and actually have to start paying the fiddler. But I don't think there's any appetite in Washington or at the Fed to actually do the quote unquote right thing. But this just goes to show you that whether it's the central planners at the Fed, whether it's the central planners in the government, or our institutions that we have here in the United States and around the world, you can't trust them. And it's not just George Gammon saying that. Just put on your critical thinking cap and ask yourself, have these people been honest in the past? Since we've had, we'll call it the Cerveza sickness, to be YouTube friendly, have these politicians been forthright? Have they been humble to the point where if they don't know something, they'll come out and say, you know what? We just don't know right now. Here's our educated guess, but we could be wrong. Here's all the data. You know, you as a public citizen can make a decision that's right for you and your family based on your own personal risk reward. They've never once come out and done that. They've never once treated, at least here in the United States, the population as adults. They've been treating us like three-year-olds, but three-year-olds that really aren't cognizant of what's going on. And not only do they come right out and contradict themselves, but they just blatantly lie. You know, even the Biden administration here, and I'm not, you know, favoring one side or the other. I dislike both parties equally. But, you know, they've come out and said that they've lied in the past because if they didn't lie, then the people wouldn't do what they wanted them to do. And we've seen that with institutions here in the United States. And I can't name any names here again to kind of keep it YouTube friendly, but I think most of your viewers and listeners, even if they're in Australia, will know exactly who I'm referring to, multiple people. So how far can you push that envelope, right? And at what point does it become like Stockholm syndrome, where people just have this irrational emotional connection with people who are lying to them, who are trying to manipulate them, and constantly contradict themselves and openly do it, right? And I think it's the exact same thing at the Fed. Now, look at what they did with ever since 2008. I mean, it goes back further than that, Martin, but let's just use 2008. The GFC is a good example. You know, Bernanke, well, actually, let's do go back, because remember what the politicians and Ben Bernanke was saying, that everything is contained, that subprime is contained. And those people like Chris Dodd and Barney Frank, those politicians here in the United States, while this whole bubble was bursting, they were saying that we needed to continue to lower the lending standards for housing, all in the name of quote unquote equality. When of course, all of those poor and middle class that the politicians pushed into getting loans, and even if they were putting up a 1% or a 3% down payment, the bottom line, it was their entire life savings. And every one of those people got completely wiped out. Well, how are they held accountable for those actions? Well, the way they're held accountable here in the United States is those politicians, we just make them in charge of creating the Dodd-Frank bill to regulate the banks that, according to them, got us into the GFC, when in reality, it was the politicians. And I'm not saying that the banks weren't to blame there, but there was plenty of blame to go around. And that included those two politicians that, ironically enough, were put in charge of trying to clean up the mess that they themselves created. So then we go to Ben Bernanke saying that the mortgage crisis and subprime is contained. How did that one work out? And then he says that QE, when he starts that, and by the way, isn't it interesting that the arsonist is always the firefighter, right? We got the Fed coming in and lowering rates and the government pushing people, and then the banksters doing all these things. And all of a sudden, who are the people that are coming in to save the day? It's the Fed and the politicians that got us into this mess in the first place. But then Bernanke comes in and says, okay, we're doing QE, and it's going to be great. It's going to be temporary. No one's ever going to know that we did it, because we're going to do it for a year, and it's going to work so magnificently well that we'll be able to reduce the size of the balance sheet right back to the $800 billion where it started at the beginning of the GFC. And I'm talking about the Fed's balance sheet. Well, how did that work out? Well, then we got QE2, then we got QE3, and then they started to taper just a little bit, and the markets freak out. Jerome Powell does a complete 180. Oh, and by the way, let's not leave Yellen out of the mix here. Remember, she said that when the Fed was going to reduce the size of their balance sheet, it would be like watching paint dry. Remember that one?
Yep.
Like watching paint. Yeah, that's didn't turn out to be like watching paint dry at all. It turned out to be a lot like watching a house of cards crumble right in front of your eyes. It was like watching a train wreck, a slow motion train wreck, when we saw what was happening to markets as a result of their tapering, which was supposed to be like watching paint dry. But so that was just chalk one other thing up to these central planners that contradict themselves, but often do so in a way that's just blatantly obvious when you look at it in hindsight, but yet we continue to put our 100% faith and confidence in these people that have given us no reason to trust them whatsoever. And now we've got Jerome Powell coming out, and let's remember that QE Infinity is now at $120 billion per month. I'd love to hear what Ben Bernanke has to say about that. You know, if we could go back in a time machine to 2008, you know, fast forward 12, 11 years, and that temporary program, there we, again, let's define temporary. You know, is temporary the same as you know, inflation being transitory? I guess they'd have the same definition there, wouldn't they, Martin? Because we're still in it, you know, 12 years later. But then the central planner, meaning Jerome Powell, head of the Fed chair, is telling us that inflation is this, it's that, and we should continue to trust him. But yet a year and a half later, somehow inflation hasn't gone away. And even according to what he is saying, that it's remained annoyingly persistent. So, you know, at one level, you can sit here and say, okay, well, is inflation transitory? Is it more permanent? But I think you've got to step back and zoom out and ask yourself, why on earth is the media and the general public taking anything they say at face value? Why are they putting their trust and confidence in the Federal Reserve and the politicians, or with the people that we have here in the United States that are in charge of these institutions? The only thing I can figure out is Stockholm syndrome.
Well, it's very interesting. Mervyn King was the guy in charge of the Bank of England when QE was started in 2008. And he actually wrote a report quite recently in the House of Lords looking at quantitative easing in the UK. And he concluded, and the other people who actually looked at that, concluded that quantitative easing was not what was advertised it was doing. What it was doing was just driving the cost of government debt down. There's no evidence that it actually made any real impact on the real economy, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that's probably the first articulation of, you know, somebody who was around at the start of QE saying, hang on a moment, it's gone off the rails, right? And just think about what QE is, because, of course, basically it's lifting the balances on one side, lifting the balances on the other side, you know, it's issue. And then, of course, the money flows back via reverse repos into the central bank again. So it's all artificial, isn't it?
It absolutely is. But at least that's one person that's coming out and admitting they got it wrong. I think that's a step in the right direction. If the people here in the United States or at the Fed would do the same thing, I think that you know, we would all be much better off. But I don't see them going down that path anytime soon.
No, and you made the other point, which is one that I get very frustrated about. It's like the Federal Reserve or the other central bankers, you know, are almost regarded as godlike figures who have these tablets that they deliver every, you know, every few weeks with the latest edict, right? And then you've got the journalists and the economists parsing their every word and trying to give nuance here and nuance there. It's like, but ask the hard questions. Nobody wants to ask the hard questions. Why is that?
I think it's because there's this synergistic relationship between the media and the politicians. The media knows that the politicians get them clicks and views, and then the politicians know that they can increase their power, their clout, their notoriety through the media. And so the one hand doesn't want to fight the other. And I think that's what explains most of it. But, you know, for a moment, I want to go back to the 1970s, because I think this further illustrates the point we were making there. And it's a story that not too many people know of. And it's a story of Arthur Burns, who was the Fed chair at the beginning of the 1970s, when here in the United States, we were having significant inflation. I think that we as students of economics today just have this idea that back in the 1970s, especially in the early 70s, that just everyone knew that inflation was going to be or was not going to be transitory. Everyone knew that inflation was going to be far more permanent. But that wasn't the case. They were having the exact same debates in the early 1970s that we are having today. And oddly enough, the Federal Reserve under Arthur Burns was saying the exact same thing that the Federal Reserve under Jerome Powell is saying today. And that's that inflation was transitory. And you can go back and read the Fed minutes, but I read an article, and I wish I could remember the author's name, but if your viewers want, I'm sure they can Google it. I think it's called The Ghost of Arthur Burns, or it had something like that in the title. But the gentleman that wrote this worked under Arthur Burns at the Fed during this time. So maybe he was a young intern or something like that. So he got to see firsthand how they were handling this inflation problem. And maybe more importantly, this expectations policy, the manipulation of the psychology of the general public and the participants in the market. But initially, it was oil. So he said, okay, well, and now I'm talking about the metrics that make up the CPI. He said, okay, well, this is going to solve itself because the cure for high prices are high prices, and this is just a supply chain issue, or this is just because of XYZ. So when oil prices come down, you know, inflation does. So you can't really consider that in the CPI because that's just temporary. So when you omit that, well, now all of a sudden we don't really have too much inflation. So you can imagine him saying this maybe in 1972. But then inflation continued to go up, even when you omit oil, like he was trying to do. So then he said, you know what the cause is now? It's anchovies. The little, I don't know what you guys call them there, but those little fish, you know? Yes. I guess there was some sort of like weather pattern, some weird weather pattern where the harvest, that's what you call it for anchovies, was super thin, and it shot the price of anchovies up like, I don't know if it doubled or tripled, something like that, maybe something similar to what we saw with lumber. And Arthur Burns said, well, this is why we're getting all of this inflation, because anchovies are a key component in fertilizer, therefore food, and they're a key component in feed for like cattle or hogs or pigs or chickens or whatever. So it's really being transmitted through the entire process, and so it's being expressed through food prices. But it all boils down to the anchovy price tripling or quadrupling or whatever it did. So he said, well, so now since that's temporary, obviously, because it's just this freak weather storm that we got, well, then we need to really omit food prices from the CPI. So now all of a sudden, oil prices, energy prices are gone, and the food prices are gone as well. And then he's saying the same thing Jerome Powell was saying. Well, when you exclude these two things, well, now look, we don't really have too much inflation. And what he did through the span of the next, call it 2 years, is he kept omitting metric after metric after metric after metric out of the CPI until they were only left with about 35% of the original components that made the CPI. And then this was like 1974, 75, even that 30 or 35% was going up at like 10 or 15% per year, where finally even Arthur Burns admitted that he was wrong. He made a mistake, and that this inflation was not transitory in any way, shape, or form. So I just think it's so ironic to look at what's happening today and what Jerome Powell is saying through the lens of history and what happened with the Federal Reserve and Arthur Burns in the early 1970s.
That's very insightful. And of course, it's worth reflecting on the fact that more recently, inflation has been recalibrated, right? And so, for example, in Australia, costs of housing aren't really in the inflation numbers. They sort of have a quasi-rental proxy, right?
That's what we do too. Yeah, we call it owner's equivalent rents.
Yeah, but what it basically says is that the real costs for real people, right, isn't reflected in the CPI number. It's artificially low. And so there's been an attempt. And by the way, here, the Reserve Bank in Australia was the entity who actually pushed that through to basically make CPI lower. So if you think about that, what that says is actually that the inflation target that they're actually targeting is artificially reported low based on the way that they measure CPI to start with, which suggests that they've actually got rates way lower than they should be based on where CPI really is.
That's a great point. We do the exact same thing here. First of all, with our CPI in the United States, if it was measured the same way that the actual government measured it back during the 1980s, let's say, it would be far higher than it is today. But let's look at the owner equivalent rent here, because we did the same thing. I don't recall when they made the transition from home prices to rents, but they're still underplaying the rents themselves. Let me give you an example. If you look at the CPI here in the United States, they're saying that rents last year, they, the Fed, went up by about 2 to 3%. 2 to 3%. Right. But if you look at realtor.com, which is, I don't know if you guys have realtor.com there, but it's pretty much a website. It's like the MLS, where almost every rental property or house that's listed for sale by an agent will go up on realtor.com. So they have incredible amounts of data. According to their numbers, during that same time frame, rents went up by almost 12%. So there's a 10% Delta. Yep. And for those of your viewers or listeners who say, oh, well, that's just rents. Right. But rents in the United States make up about 20% of the total CPI. So if you get that wrong, you get the entire thing wrong. And as we can see, you know, what's interesting too, Martin, is they never err on the upside. You notice that? Whenever they change the calculation, it always makes inflation go lower than it otherwise would be. So I think that in and of itself should tell you what their motives are.
Right. Now, you talked about financial repression earlier on. I just want to come back to that because I think that's a really, really important concept that people may not recognize, although they'll recognize the symptoms of it, right? But what it essentially is saying is that, you know, this is not a free economy anymore. This is not something which essentially has the normal supply-demand balances in the economy. It is all controlled, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, we go back to the 1940s in the United States, and what this financial repression is really just negative real rates. So that means that savers, that means people that hold bonds, that interest rate that they're getting is going to be less than the rate of inflation. So they are losing purchasing power. And let's think about what that means. Milton Friedman called it the hidden tax, but it's not just a hidden tax. It's a regressive tax in the sense that it disproportionately affects the poor and middle class. Not that they have a lot of the assets, but when you think about the percentage of their overall income that goes to housing, that goes to energy, that goes to food, if inflation is going up, they are really, really getting pinched. And so if the government or the Fed is creating this financial repression to create inflation, CPI going up, the cost of goods and services, then basically what they're doing is they're stealing purchasing power from the poor and middle class to pay for all the profligate spending that the politicians are doing in order to buy votes to get reelected to gain that power in the first place.
Yeah. When you put it as boldly as that, you can see precisely the problem. And, you know, I keep coming back to the economy is not working for the bulk of people, right? So there is a small proportion who are doing extremely well, and particularly those who are in politics and in power and, you know, who have lots of property and those sorts of things. But most ordinary people are really up against it at the moment. I see that in my surveys. A lot of people saying, I don't understand what's happening because I've got no income growth, costs of living are rising, costs of accommodation, you know, mortgages are going up, etc. It is a very, very insidious process or set of processes, right? And then effectively the vote buying is aiming policies at those sufficiently large of a proportion of the total to get you reelected, right? So this is, to my mind, all about staying in power, getting reelected. It's not about setting a strategic future for the economy or the country or for businesses or anything. It's a purely practical, tactical, frankly, very insidious set of processes, right? Which is just about self-perpetuation.
Yeah, and it just benefits the lobbyists and the self-interest groups and, you know, the big corporations, really. You know, people look at the United States and think that we have free market capitalism here, and that couldn't be further from the truth. Now, it's not like we have straight up communism, but we do have capitalism. I would admit to that. We do have capitalism. But what most people are missing in that equation is the phrase free market. Those two words are incredibly important. That is what we do not have in the United States, is free market capitalism. And the example I would give is the GFC. Or just look at what happened in 2020 during the Cervasa sickness. The Fed came out and bailed out everybody. And in the GFC, we bailed out all the banksters. That is not free market capitalism. That might be capitalism in the sense of private property rights and ownerships, but we're basically socializing the losses and we're privatizing the profits. No. In free market capitalism, there are no bailouts. In free market capitalism, we have something called Schumpeter's creative destruction. And that's where we allow businesses, even banks, to fail. But unfortunately, because the market has been so financialized, and what's interesting is this problem even goes back to Bretton Woods in 1944, if you want to talk about unintended consequences. Because if you really want to go down the rabbit hole with me, Martin, 1944, we had Bretton Woods. Well, there was a gentleman by the name of Triffin. And you got to give Keynes credit, too, because Keynes pointed this out. That we would have this, he didn't call it Triffin's dilemma back then, but that's what we know it today, that if you have one nation that's in charge of the global reserve currency, that's going to be a problem because they're not going to be able to run big enough trade deficits to get enough dollars out to the world to facilitate maximum growth for all of these other countries that are just as important. And in an effort to do so, we'll just completely hollow out our manufacturing base, and then at some point in time, like around 1971, that system will implode because all those foreigners with those green pieces of paper will want to redeem them for gold, and there's just not enough gold. You can pretty much get a run on the bank, which is what 1971 was all about. But what happened in the interim was a system sprung up out of necessity, and this was called the Euro-dollar system. So there wasn't enough dollars getting outside of the United States. So all of these banks, international banks, they were in Switzerland, the Cayman Islands, Hong Kong, wherever they were at the time, they were able to create dollar-denominated debt or extend dollar-denominated credit. And they did so for liquidity, for growth, for all these foreign corporations. So that's how the market satisfied the need of having dollars to settle all of those transactions, especially when they went to the petrodollar in 1974. So this was something that sprung up out of the market. Now, the problem with that is that these banks in the Eurodollar system became responsible for creating the majority of dollars or dollar-denominated liquidity throughout the globe and for the global economy. And they really controlled the dollar monetary system far more than the Fed. And you and I, prior to recording, were talking about my discussion with Richard Werner, and we're both huge fans of Professor Werner. Mm. And he pointed out that the commercial banks prior to the GFC were responsible for creating about 97% of the new dollars. And you know who else does great work on this is your fellow Australian, Steve Keen, who's another guy that I've interviewed. I think you have too, and he's just fantastic. I always call him the rebel economist.
he's standing for Parliament.
Yeah. Oh, is he?
Yes.
Good for Steve. Okay. So, but Steve points this out that, you know, prior to the GFC especially, that we got into the system where the commercial banks were creating 97% of the dollars. And domestically, that makes a lot of sense, but people don't recognize how important this euro-dollar system was to the overall operation of not just the domestic economy in the United States, but really the global economy. So why does this matter? Because the Fed realizes that they are not in control of the dollar. The government really, at the end of the day, isn't in control of the dollar. It's the commercial banks. So if you allow the banks to fail, the whole entire house of cards comes collapsing in on itself.
Yep.
Because we've created this system that is reliant on the banks for producing that dollar liquidity. Why is that dollar liquidity important? Well, let's just go back to Lehman Brothers. You know, why did they go bust? It was because all of a sudden they had to mark their assets to the market price. And they went out to the repo market because they had all these assets that were illiquid, but were still assets on their balance sheet that, you know, within, ironically enough, within a year or two's time, they rebounded in price and were probably very near where they were before the crisis. And so then they went to the repo market to get the overnight funding. They needed the liquidity they needed to stay in business. And the repo market basically gave them the finger. And because they couldn't get that liquidity they needed, they went bankrupt. They went tits up. So my point is that if the Fed allowed the commercial banks, the JP Morgans, the Goldman Sachs, the Wells Fargo, the Bank of America's here in the United States, if they allowed them to fail, that the whole entire global system would come crashing down. So they are not only systemically important, but they are too big to fail. And therefore, that takes on a moral hazard of its own to where they can create more and more risk and they don't have to worry about it, more risk on their balance sheet. And they don't have to worry about it because they know they're going to be bailed out at the end of the day, whether it's during the GFC or whether it's 2020 or whether it's into the future. And the negative impact that has on the real economy, not only here, but in Australia, is that financializes the economy because the banks going back and forth with one another, creating derivatives and just having to make money on mortgages, et cetera, basically credit extension. This is how Professor Warner would describe it. You have credit expansion for the purchase of assets and people shy or these banks move away from credit expansion to businesses for productive, to produce productivity and create more goods and services, which is the true wealth in society.
Absolutely. And 2 points, of course. Ask who owns the Fed. Well, funnily enough, those large financial institutions are intrinsically involved in the ownership of the Fed, aren't they, firstly? And secondly, the fact of the matter is that you actually create more and more credit when you want it. I mean, that, you know, that the point is banks, commercial banks can create more credit whenever they want to. It's just an electronic entry, right? So they can go on lending if there are people who are willing to lend. And guess who is willing to borrow? Well, it's the financial sector relating to mortgages. So that's why we've seen this massive drift into more and more and more credit for mortgages, which drives house prices up. In Australia, the banks here have more than 60% of their total credit into the housing sector. And then, of course, again, that's another too big to fail. You can't possibly allow house prices to slide, because if you allowed house prices to slide, that would put pressure on the banks. The banks would then cascade and collapse, and that would create you the financial crisis. So basically, you've got a too big to fail system created by the very process that actually drove credit in the first place.
Yeah, and I think that in the past couple decades, how real estate, especially in the United States, Canada, and Australia, has become a massive systemic risk, to your point, for the overall economy. Unfortunately, here in the United States especially, I believe that not only is it the U.S. housing market, but it's also the stock market.
Yep.
So if you can imagine what would happen in Australia, as an example, if housing prices went down by 50% and stayed there. Just use that as a thought experiment. What would happen to the economy? I think the same thing would happen here in the United States if the stock market went down by 50 or 60% and stayed down, something similar to what we saw in Japan during the 1990s.
Absolutely. And that takes me to the sort of the last chunk of this conversation, which what I call the value hook, you know, the value lever. The point is, we know that stock market prices are way too high, probably against fundamentals. We know that house prices are way too high. So people are then trying to work out what that means in terms of what's the relative value of things. You know, the US dollar, is it too high? Some people are saying, well, it's got to be gold because gold is that long-term point of a value anchorage. I find it very complicated and difficult to try and explain to people. It's all in flux at the moment. There is no clear point of value anchor. But I don't know whether you see it the same way as I do. But that's what, you know, there is no security. There's no safety in this.
I completely agree. It's a house of mirrors, what we'd say in the United States. And you can't tell what's up. You can't tell what's down. You can't really determine the true price of anything. And I know for your viewers and listeners, that may sound kind of esoteric, but let me explain it this way, and I think it'll make a lot of sense. We have to understand what interest rates are, right? So interest rates are the price of money. That's a price, and those prices tell us a lot. You know, that's what made the difference between communist Russia imploding and the system we had here in the United States. One of the big components there was the price signals and price discovery. Okay, so we understand that. What is the Federal Reserve doing and central banks? Well, they are manipulating the price of money. They're bringing that overnight rate all the way down to 0%. The zero lower bound. So are we going to assume that if the Fed just stopped doing quantitative easing, if they sat back and said, you know what, we're not going to do anything, we're going to take our balance sheet back down to $800 billion, we're going to let rates just go to wherever they want to go, and I'd like to remind all your viewers that they went up to 10% in the repo market in 2019 in September. That should tell you where interest rates might want to go if it wasn't for the Fed. You know, if they did that, then rates most likely would be far different. That is my point. And so we can safely conclude that the Fed is manhandling interest rates. They are artificial interest rates. Therefore, the price of money is artificial. We don't really know what the price of money is. But now let's take it another step. Well, the money is one half of every single transaction, right? If you go down to the local grocery store and buy a 2-liter bottle of Coca-Cola, if you go out and buy a car, if you go buy Bitcoin, if you buy gold, if you buy a barrel of oil, if you buy a home, well, you have to pay dollars or your local currency in order to get that good or service. You have to give them money for that. Well, if you can't determine the price of money, or if the price of money is artificial, then effectively every single price in the entire economy for everything is distorted, and you really truly don't know how much that can of Coke should cost. You don't know what gold should be. You don't know what housing should be, because the price of money itself is manipulated.
Yeah, absolutely right. And that's the whole point, right? The manipulation is from soup to nuts, right? It's not
right.
Just in particular asset classes. And by the way, I'd also make the point that cryptocurrencies are in the same boat, right? So I know that there are some people who claim
everything you're buying with money is in the same boat, because the price of money is distorted.
Right. So then the next question which follows from that is, if we're in the situation where the value of nothing is clear, and the value of everything is clear, the value of nothing is nothing as well, you've got no idea, right? Where does this take us ahead, right? Because it seems to me that we're in the situation now where we are not going to get out of this scot-free. One way or the other, this is going to actually end in tears. It's a question of which way the tears will be created, you know. And you, there's an argument to say, well, maybe ultimately stock markets will see they've got no clothes and markets will crash, or we'll see that the tapering starts, or the tapering goes on and, you know, the dance just continues for a bit longer. And I guess the sort of the question behind the question is there an underlying intent, or is this just the cock-up theory of history in play?
Well, let's start with your first point and go back to communist Russia. And remember, we were saying earlier that the collapse of communist Russia, one of the key components is there was no price discovery. There were no price signals, and therefore they couldn't allocate scarce resources efficiently. And after doing that for decades, the whole system imploded. So if we don't have any price discovery in the Western world or in any economy where central banks are manipulating money, therefore manipulating the prices, by definition, we have no price discovery, or at least not pure price discovery. Therefore, how can we expect that we will have any other outcome than what we saw in communist Russia? And that's an implosion of the entire system, because our scarce resources with alternative uses are not being allocated efficiently. So that would be point number one. On your second point, say, is this intentional? Is this unintentional? Is this the central planners at the World Economic Forum? Are these the politicians? Is this just a comedy of errors? Is this just because they are so incredibly incompetent? Or is it just that they all have this insatiable lust for power, so they'll do anything in order to get reelected? And it just turns out that anything is manipulating prices and puts us on the road to, from a freedom standpoint, I think it puts us on the road to serfdom, to a totalitarian police state. But from an economic standpoint, it takes us to a collapse in the overall system. It's very difficult to, I don't think anyone knows for sure. It's like anything else, there are no certainties. There are only probabilities. I know here in the United States, what I do often is look at what these central planners are saying. And the fact that they contradict themselves so often and just blatantly, it brings you to a conclusion that there's something else going on behind the scenes. So what I say on my Twitter feed all the time is an example here in New York City, or in a lot of areas, and this comes straight from the Biden administration. Anyone in these institutions that we've been talking about kind of toe this line, is when they talk about mandates as an example, or health passports, they completely ignore, they never even bring up what we would call natural immunity from having a prior infection from the Cerveza sickness. So if you are truly, quote unquote, following the science, you can't ignore that. And that what that means is there's a completely different risk-reward profile for every individual. So the fact that these people that run these institutions, that we are supposed to believe everything that they say, or the mainstream media or the politicians, the fact that they're not bringing that up means that they're not being intellectually honest. And if they're not being intellectually honest, then in my opinion, and this may, that it's just an opinion, I'm not saying this is, you know, empirically true, it's at the end of the day, it's not about health. It's to your point, it's about something else. So what is it? Is it just them taking advantage of a crisis? We had that politician here say that you never let a good crisis go to waste. I believe he was the mayor of Chicago. So is it that, or is it some greater influence from, let's say, the World Economic Forum, where these politicians are just being used as puppets or as useful idiots, as Stalin and Lenin would refer to them? I think there's a decent argument for that as well, because of the language that's used by a lot of politicians here in the United States. Biden uses this language all the time. And up north of us, Trudeau uses the language nonstop. And that, what language am I referring to? It's the same kind of script that you hear out of the IMF and out of the World Economic Forum. And so they're all going to Davos. They're all meeting. So I think that it's kind of naive to believe that that group of global elite doesn't have some sort of influence on these politicians. I don't know if your viewers have read the book, what was it, The Stories of an Economic Hitman? I believe, was that the name of the book? But he basically talked, and now whether this is true or not, I don't know, but he basically said how, I think he was working for the IMF, he would go into specific countries, these smaller countries, like let's say Ecuador or some smaller country in Africa, and he would want them to do, or the IMF, would want them to do X, Y, and Z. And if they did X, Y, and Z, they would get a loan for, let's say, $1 billion to create this infrastructure program. And if they didn't do X, Y, or Z, they would basically say, we're going to kill your family, or we're going to do, we're going to make sure that you don't win the next election. So it becomes that where this politician has absolutely no choice but to go along with whatever the IMF tells them to do. And so could this be what's happening? I don't know. Another thing that I would suggest that there's some form of power grab at the extreme top with Davos crowd is you look at the ESDR, the digital SDR. I don't know if your viewers are familiar with that, but that's a special drawing right. Yep. That's basically the currency that is issued by the IMF. Well, their big push now is to have the digital SDR as the global reserve asset for central banks. And they want this to replace gold and, of course, the dollar. Well, if we go back and think about this quote-unquote exorbitant privilege the United States has had, I'm sure your viewers know the economic impact of what I'm referring to, having the global reserve currency and how we have basically been able to consume far, 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 far more than we produce, because all we have to produce are these green pieces of paper and all the foreigners just make us goods and send them to us. And then they buy our treasuries. That keeps the interest rates low for us, which means more credit creation and kind of a higher standard of living. That higher standard of living doesn't come with as a result of productivity, right? So that's this exorbitant privilege. Also, I would argue, look at the power that the United States has had on a global scale since 1944. And, we've got, 900 military bases all over the world? And I'm not going to argue whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, but the bottom line is the United States is, and I know it's waning right now, but for the last decades, since 1944, really, the United States has been the global superpower. And I want to emphasize the word power. So if we can safely conclude that one of the main reasons they have been the global superpower is because they have the global reserve currency, well, then what happens if that global reserve currency or global reserve asset turns into the digital SDR? Well, all that exorbitant privilege and power that one country had, that at least has elected officials, would all go to the IMF. And the IMF and the World Economic Forum are really tied at the hip. So I don't want to get too conspiratorial, but I do want to use common sense and I want to use critical thinking. And when you use critical thinking, the conclusion that must be drawn is that the probability of this being the motives being nefarious or authoritarian are far higher than zero.
Mm. Well, it's interesting. You know, as I say, cock up or something more. I think the something more story begins to hold more and more water, particularly when you start overlaying digital, global, and all of those things. Last question, though, is parallels to the fall of Rome.
Yeah.
You made some interesting comments about that, and it might be worth just touching on those, because, you know, it seems to me that we have a situation where every advanced society eventually falls in on itself. Do you think we're close to that now?
Yeah, because if you look at history going back, boy, through the Sumerians, we're talking about 7,000 BC, if my memory serves me right. And you take it through that empire all the way through, you know, the Ottoman Empire, the Roman Empire, the Byzantine Empire, and you see that it's just the same story over and over and over again. They start off strong, they get rich, and then they get extremely weak. They devalue the currency. They try to take devalue money, I should say. And they take the easy road out, or the easy path, and the whole entire empire collapses in on itself. And to illustrate that, you know, they have that saying, which I think is so powerful and just so true, that hard times create strong men, and strong men create good times. Good times create weak men, and weak men create hard times, and then you go right back into the cycle. And you saw it throughout all of the empires that I just mentioned, and I think that's exactly what we are seeing today in Western society.
And so, you know, what does that mean then for individuals trying to sort of, you know, get up in the morning and go to work and deal with all of the, you know, day-to-day frustrations of ordinary life, right? Because all of this stuff that we've been talking about for the last hour sounds highfalutin over there somewhere, but it does have immediate impacts on real people, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. I think for the average Joe and Jane, it's just, you have to recognize the government is going to do everything in their power to create inflation, consumer price inflation. I want to be clear, because there's, you know, it's inflation where the value of the currency is going down relative to other currencies. Is it asset prices? I think they have to bail themselves out because they're so overlevered. And the only way to get, let's use the United States as an example, because I'm very familiar with those numbers. They're at 130% debt to GDP. So in order to get that number down to something more manageable, let's say 60 or 70%, we have to have a 1970s here. And in order to do that, they've got to get permanent, consistent inflation, which is what I think the Fed actually wants. They're just not coming out and admitting it. They need that financial repression that you talked about at the beginning of the video. So I would make sure that people are thinking through the ramifications of what that means to the purchasing power of whatever asset it is, especially cash, that they have on their balance sheet, and how to position themselves accordingly. And what I'm not saying is that it can happen all in a straight line. Like we go from A to B just like this. What you see is it's always kind of up and down and up and down. And right now in the United States, it really depends on how those dollars are being created. Because if we're just reliant on the commercial banking system, we have seen the extension of credit here actually decline substantially when you look at a time frame from about, call it April or May, when we got done with the PPP loans here, to today. So that would be an extreme deflationary pressure, but that's been offset by the government spending money into existence, by the Fed monetizing the debt and buying the majority of those treasuries that Janet Yellen is issuing. So in that environment, we are at the mercy of the central planners, the politicians. You know, are they going to come out with a $5 trillion stimulus package? Okay, if they do, then you're probably going to see an inflation spike again. And again, we're talking about consumer prices. But if they don't, if there's gridlock in Washington and they don't come to an agreement, well, then you're going to see disinflation, where prices are still going up, but they're going up at a much lower rate. And then if we go back to where we were, we might even see some deflation, especially in asset prices. But then if we move into this world where we have a central bank digital currency, what that means is that we all have an account with the central bank, and therefore they can take those bank reserves, which is really the only thing that they can create, and they can turn those effectively into legal tender, because they can deposit those directly into your account, and you can spend those as normal dollars in the real economy. So then they can control velocity much better, because they can just put a time limit on the spending for your, let's call it UBI, and they can make sure that they get inflation up to where Uncle Sam, in this case, needs it in order to be bailed out. Well, if they move into that system, then I hate to say it, but you want to make sure that your portfolio is in line with the central or with the government, meaning that you've got good, solid, productive, fixed rate debt, or you've got gold, you've got something that they can't print. And I don't know what that is in Australia, because the housing market there is so high that you don't want to be forced into buying a real asset if that real asset itself is at nosebleed levels and in a bubble. Therefore, you're taking on maybe even more risk than you have with inflation risk and losing purchasing power with your cash position. So, but I just, at the very least, I think, yeah, you gotta own 10% of your portfolio needs to be in precious metals or dividend paying stocks and commodities or something like that.
Right, and so that's the point, really. High levels of uncertainty, right? It could be an inflationary or a deflationary future. It could be one where essentially we get more intervention and, as you say, digital currencies and even maybe negative interest rates, right? So the level of uncertainty is as probably high as it's ever been. And that should shape the way that individuals think about their financial position and individuals think about, you know, their investment portfolios and things, right? I don't think there's any silver bullet answer. Right. And I get very frustrated when people say, oh, look, you know, simple, go crypto or go gold or what, you know, whatever it is. Right. They've all got things to sell, but I'm not sure that actually it really helps. And, you know, hopefully this conversation, George, has helped people to understand why we're saying some of the things that we're saying in terms of the complexity that we're in at the moment. Right. But the other point to make is complexity is important to understand. Right. Because there's two attitudes. One is it's all too complicated, I'm just going to forget it and go off and do my normal things. The other is get to understand a bit more of this, because if you do understand a bit more what's going on, you'll make better decisions, won't you?
Yeah. So what I was just writing down there is what I try to encourage everyone to do is you got to know what you don't know. And that so few people, it sounds simple. So few people do that. And if you really think that through, it's extremely powerful. The other thing that you were saying that I'd like to comment on is how uncertain the world we live in is today. So this is not the 1980s where you can just buy a bond, you know, at a 15% interest rate, set it and forget it, and you know, just have the 60-40 portfolio, and you're just going to do great for the next three decades and retire, and just do what all your friends do. And you're going to be fine. We do not live in those times anymore. They may be in the future, but they are not here now. So I think the real takeaway probably for this video, if someone were to take away just one message, is that the more uncertain times get, the more research you have to do. And it's not pleasant, it's not fair, but it is what it is. If you look around the world and you see all this uncertainty, that should tell you that you just need to do that much more research to be cognizant of the world around you so you can make better financial decisions for you and your family moving forward.
Yeah, great advice, George. And, you know, your channel, my channel, other channels out there are all about trying to tell people more about what's going on, not because we want to sell a particular solution, but to help people make better decisions, make more adult decisions, going back to that child adult thing, right? Because frankly, mainstream media is all treating us like kids. Now is the time to really understand. George, if people want to find out more about you, where do they go?
oh, you can just Google my name. It's typical spelling. George, last name is Gammon, G-A-M-M-O-N. I'm everywhere on YouTube, on Twitter, Instagram. I think I even got a Facebook page, but you just Google my name and everything will pop up.
Terrific. Well, I really appreciate your time today. Thank you very much for sharing your insights. Always love chatting with you because we go into some deep and dark places, but with good intent, I think, George.
That's right. That's right. Thanks for having me on, Martin.
Okay. Take care. See you soon.